This is HPR episode 2446 entitled Git Server and Git Hooks. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 41 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is, Klaatu talks about running Git on a server and explains Git Hooks.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi everybody, this is Ken from HPR with an important. From Wednesday the 20th of December 2017, the media in the HPR feeds will be served via a redirect from archive.org. If you run into any problems, can you email admin@hackerpublicradio.org? We've done quite a lot of testing and I'd like to thank everybody who helped out on that on the mailing list. So nothing should change and nothing should be impacted. All the URLs are going to remain in the feeds. It's just that for new shows, they will be downloaded via a 302 redirect to archive.org and they'll be downloaded directly from there. So we don't expect your problem, but if there is, contact us, it'd be great. The reason behind this is that Josh at anhonesthost.com, who's been providing our servers, has been receiving an unacceptable amount of traffic over the last period of, and that's resulted in slowdowns on the website and lots of issues. So hopefully this move will take some of the burden off the website. In addition to that, if you can throw a few shekels in the direction of Josh, we would appreciate it. If you go to any page on the HPR website, there's information there on how you help him. So once again, as of Wednesday, the 20th of December, 2017, the media for the HPR feeds will be served via a redirect from archive.org. Thank you very much for your.
Hi everyone, this is Klaatu. You're listening to Hacker Public Radio. I'm going to talk about Git servers. You can run your own Git server, you can use someone else's Git server. There are lots of ways to make Git available to yourself or to others on a very massive scale. So I want to talk about three different options that you have. I'm going to skim over the one, and then I'm going to go into great detail about the other two. So the one that I'm going to skim over is maybe the obvious one to a lot of people. It's this quote-unquote social coding sites, and I'm going to just use social coding so that I don't have to keep naming different services that are out there that you might look into. But the social coding sites are those big cloud-based Git hosts that kind of popularized Git, I think, or maybe they responded to the popularity of Git. I don't know, chicken, egg. Either way, they're very popular, and a lot of people use them. And to a lot of people, these social coding sites literally are Git. Like, that's what Git is. And any other approach to Git is kind of a weird hack or something that only people do to be contrary. So it's a huge deal, and that's kind of part of the benefit. The social coding sites are out there. They're pretty well known, some more than others. So you get a lot of eyes on your code, in theory. I don't know how I feel about the success rate of this for myself, for instance. There have been projects that I've put on GitLab or GitHub when I really want to get a lot of eyes on something, and they just kind of get overlooked. But I'm going to temper that with a little anecdote, which is yesterday I was on GitHub for work, and I typed my name into the search box because I thought I was looking for repositories within my namespace. And it turns out that I was searching for my name across all of GitHub, which I didn't even know that was possible. But I ended up doing that, and when my name came up, it showed me like where my name was in people's repositories. It was quite interesting, actually. And I actually did not know that there was this functionality. It just never occurred to me. But you can totally scrape all the files in everyone's repositories on GitHub, or at least the public ones, by just searching in a search box that I don't really know how I got there, though, so I can't tell you where to find that search box. But it exists, and I typed my name into it, and every time that my name appeared in someone's repository, in code in someone's repository, or text fields in someone's repository, it came up. And so one of the things that came up was something called CBR2CBZ, and I thought, wow, that's interesting. I have a project called CBR2CBZ, but it's not on GitHub, so that can't be mine, and it must not be related to mine. Oh, wait, my name is in it. So I went to look at this repository, and it turns out that someone had somehow found a little stupid little script that I had written a long time ago, like two years ago, just because I had a bunch of .cbr files, comic book files, CBR files, and I wanted to to make them into CBZ files, because CBZ files are the things that my particular devices actually can read, whereas none of my devices take .cbr files. The difference, as it happens, is that .cbr files are zipped up or whatever, archived with the RAR, R-A-R, archive tool, which I think is kind of a Windows thing, but there is an unrar for Linux, and then the Z extension means that it has been zipped up. So I had written this little script to automate the process of translating CBR to CBZ, and I put it on GitLab just because, I mean, it was a stupid script, but I figured, well, maybe I'll need it someday. And so I threw it up there and kind of forgot about it, as you do. And so someone had found this stupid little script, and they brought it over into their GitHub account and uploaded it, and kindly retained credit, because I did not demand credit. The license was the WTF public license, so you can pretty much do whatever you want to with it. And they retained my name, which was nice, and they improved the script, because apparently there had been an error. For some stupid reason, I had used 7-zip, I don't know, P7-zip, I don't remember why I did that. I'm sure I had some reason, but maybe I couldn't find out the syntax for zip. I hate zip. But anyway, so I used L7 or P7-zip or whatever, and I guess there had been an error in some cases. So they swapped it out for generic zip, which turns out probably is better anyway. And yeah, it was really cool, and I just saw this, and it hadn't just been one person, it was like two different people, because there was my name, there was someone else's name, and then there was the third person's name whose repository it was. So the thing had passed through, I don't know, at least two, but possibly a total of three, including me, people's hands, so at least one, possibly two people's hands, and had just ended up, you know, out there in the world, and I never knew about it until I accidentally stumbled across it because they kindly gave me credit. So that was really cool, and kind of, I mean, that was not a project that I ever thought, oh, I need a lot of eyes on this, I hope that I can build a community around, and I don't know if two people or one people counts as a community, but it was still a neat thing to see. So anecdotally, I'm saying, if you put your code on a social coding site, the chances are, let's say, better than if you put your code on your own privately hosted Git server, or if you don't put it on a server at all for anyone to see at all. So there are lots of coding sites out there. I'm going to recommend two to you. One is GitLab. GitLab seems to be pretty popular, not as ubiquitous as GitHub, which, if you're looking for a lot of eyes, just indiscriminately, I want a lot of people to see this, then probably GitHub is the way to go, because that's kind of got, I mean, it's where all the people are. Whether they like it or not, if you're in technology today, you're probably on GitHub, or the side of technology that involves looking at code and stuff. So that's GitHub. There's GitLab. The GitLab advantage for me is that it's an open stack, meaning that you can download the community edition of GitLab. You can throw it on a big server somewhere and run an organization off of it. I have worked at a place that has done this, and it does provide the same kind of pretty web interface that people kind of have become used to because of the social coding sites. But the advantage is that it's all internal. Now, I don't really see why you would do that if your goal is to get your code in front of a lot of eyes. You might as well just go online and put your stuff on the social coding sites. So there's GitHub, GitLab, and then I'm going to recommend also notabug.org. So if you're not really concerned about putting your code in front of a lot of eyes necessarily, but you want a place that does all the configuration and background work for you, then notabug.org is kind of a good place to go, because it's a completely open stack. Like, everything's, there's no community edition versus enterprise edition, anything like that. It's just completely free. It's pretty cool. It's notabug.org, and it's free and open Git repository hosting. Whether or not it's going to last forever, I don't know. Whether or not anything's going to last forever, I don't know, come to think of it. But I'm saying that very, very specifically because my old host, Gitorious.org, I guess it must have been, went under at one point. They disappeared, and they were hosting huge projects. I'm talking about Qt, and I think KDE, and you know, big projects like that. So it was huge, and it was a full free stack, and that's kind of what drove me over to GitLab eventually, because they closed up shop. So the important thing here is to remember that you can push to multiple repositories when you're using Git. I've done an episode on that here on Hacker Public Radio. Go listen to episode number 2130, I think it is. It's all about pushing to more than one remote server when you're using Git. And that way you can make all your changes and push your changes to multiple places. You're just sort of doing your own remote backups all in one go. It's really quite handy. So in other words, you can have an account on all three of these places and back up, you know, and send your code to all three of them, and it'll always be the same code base. You don't have to worry about diverging or keeping track of anything or keeping things in sync. They just stay in sync. All right, so those are all the advantages. So what are the disadvantages? Well, one of the disadvantages, like I say, is that, well, they might go away. You never know. Gitorious.org, I would have never said that was going to go away. It was huge. And, well, it wasn't huge. It wasn't GitHub huge, but it was huge. It was probably as big as GitLab, I guess. It was a great little site and completely free and had lots of open source projects on it, but it died. It went away. So you don't own the platform. You don't possess the platform. So it's always at risk of going away, like everything in this world is. So that's a disadvantage. The other big disadvantage for me that actually makes a difference, like this is the real sort of like, oh, this actually matters to me, it like to my daily sort of workflow, is hooks, access to Git hooks. Git hooks are powerful little backend scripts that you can create so that when you push something to a Git repository, it triggers some action. It can be any number of actions. In fact, that's kind of the big deal about it. It can really actually literally be anything. I mean, you could program a Git hook to, I don't know, shut down your computer whenever you push to a Git repository called power off. I don't know. You can do whatever you want. Git hooks are extremely powerful. The problem is, and I mean, they're so powerful that the social coding sites out there generally don't give you really full access to the raw power of Git hooks. GitLab, I know just from experience, has something they call web hooks, which are very, very similar. I never did figure out the setup process behind it, but I didn't really spend that much time, because when I found out that I couldn't do what I needed to do on a web hook versus a Git hook, I just stopped trying and I went and did my own Git host and did my Git hook there. So if you need really powerful workflow integration with Git, a social coding site is probably not going to provide you that. I mean, again, you could probably download GitLab and install it and kind of manage your own thing and do web hooks and figure that out. But I mean, at that point, you kind of have to wonder why you are bothering. I mean, that's not the advantages to social coding sites, in my view, is just that you get a lot of eyes. Your mileage may vary. Okay, next up is Git on a server. That is using Git on a server. It's just raw Git. It's normal old Git. So the advantages here are, well, everything that was the disadvantage to social coding. You own the whole thing. You're in control of every aspect of it. The disadvantage to running Git on a server and saying, hey, everybody, here's my server, here's Git, is that doing it that way is that Git users are your Git users are also your Unix users. So it's a one-to-one relationship. If you've got someone on the outside who wants to access the Git repository, like for pushing and pulling and, well, not pulling, but for pushing access and that sort of thing, developer access, then they have to exist on your Unix as a user on your server, which you may or may not want. Now, you can restrict them in a variety of ways by only letting them get into a Git shell, that sort of thing, but it's still something that possibly is work for you to figure out. And then you have this problem, well, now that they're a Unix user and they've got this Git, they've got access to Git, how now they've got access to all Git, so all the Git on my server, unless I come up with some special scheme. Like I off the top of my head, I guess you could somehow sort of give them a specific port number that they can SSH into and then use SSH to sort of cheroot them into a certain directory, and in that directory there's just one Git repository. But I mean, that just sounds like you're sort of inventing a back end for Git when other back ends already exist for Git hosting, rather. So it's not necessarily something that I personally would think that you would want to go super wide multi-user with. It doesn't seem like that would be the way to go. So in other words, the disadvantage to just running pure Git on a server and using that as your Git server is that there's no allowance for access management. Okay, and then the final one that we'll talk about, probably not in this episode, is Gitolite, Gitolite. It's a software package called Gitolite that you can get from gitolite.com, and it gives you all of that access management in a very interesting framework that we will talk about when I talk about Gitolite. The advantage here is that it's got access management for your Git users, so your Git users don't have to have a one-to-one relationship with who, you know, the users that actually exist on your server. The disadvantage, I guess, is again, there's no pretty web front end, so I mean, that could be a disadvantage or an advantage. For me, it's an advantage, but some people, because of the social coding sites, and that's how a lot of people are sort of getting into Git now, although I would argue that if that is your user base, like if your user base expects some kind of GUI interface into your Git server, I do think that such a thing exists. It's just not going to be a web GUI. It's going to be something like Sparkle Share or something really simple like KDE Dolphin with the Git integration module turned on, or something like Git Cola, which is a great little desktop client for Git. So there are lots of options. It's just it may not be a website. And if your users are okay with actually using an application not embedded in a web browser, you should be fine. But what I'm going to go over in this particular episode, and next one I'll do something different, but in this one I'm going to talk about a Git server. So a server running Git is what it really is. And in the next episode, I'll go over Gitolite and how to configure it and how it works, because it really is an interesting system, and better than what I'm going to talk about right now, arguably. But I want to talk about this now because it is important to kind of understand how Git is supposed to be run and how, you know, what it actually has natively versus what other services like Gitolite or anything else add to it. So to run Git on a server, you need a server, which I am doing a series on server admin, so hopefully you'll be able to set up a server if you haven't already, and then you can continue with this. And you really don't need anything too fancy. I mean, especially if it's just you and maybe a couple of other people, or certainly just you, it can be a Raspberry Pi in your bedroom. It doesn't matter. It can just be whatever server you can get, whatever you can make into a server. Now, the first thing, well, okay, so before we do anything, the first thing I should say is that SSH and Git are very tightly bound together. It again, Git doesn't require SSH, and Git has an allowance for using the Git protocol. It has a Git protocol that you can use. But typically, I think people use it over SSH because that's a more secure way to do it. And everyone's got SSH turned on anyway, so that's kind of the de facto standard. And so I'm going to go with assuming that you're using SSH as your Git portal, as it were. So first thing that you want to do is create. So if you don't know SSH that well, then you'd want to learn SSH really well, and you'd want to learn it well enough so that you can do fancy things like managing SSH keys and managing passwordless login, that sort of thing. You want to have that really, really, you want a solid understanding of that. Like, where do you put your public key when you want to authenticate to a server? Or rather, when you want to set up a server so that you can authenticate without a password, where does that public key go? Do you know? Do you know the exact file? Do you know all the different ways it can get into that file? If you don't, you want to review this stuff because it's so important for Git access, for both just running Git on a server as we are now, or if you decide to run something like Gitolite. Okay, so first thing you need to do is create a Git user. You don't have to, but you should. So you just do an add user Git user, or user add, and then dash m, git user, whatever, however you want to create that user, it's up to you. Then you switch over to that user, and you want to create your initial .ssh framework with appropriate permissions. And this is important because this is how you are going to access Git on this server. So you just do an su space dash space git user, and then you can make your directory.ssh. And you can chmod the .ssh directory to 700. You kind of have to do that because SSH will fail if the permissions are not strict enough. And then you can do a touch.ssh/authorized_keys, and you can chmod that, you must chmod that, to 600. Authorized key file, that holds all the public keys of developers that you're going to let use your Git repositories. So if that developer is just you, then you need to put your public key in that file. If it's other people, then they need to send you their public key so that you can put their public key into that file. So this is all pretty standard kind of SSH setup stuff. The difference, I guess, is that usually when you're setting up an SSH authorized keys file, it's probably just a collection of your keys, of your personal keys. And this is different because you're giving a bunch of people permission to log into this server as some entity called git user. So once a developer sends you a key, all you're going to want to do is cat developer bob.pub into redirect into /home/git user /.ssh/authorized_keys. And now that the public key is in the authorized keys, the developer named Bob, I think I said, will presumably have the private key on his machine. And so he can SSH into the server as git user, so git user at example.com, and then with a dash I probably would be the identity file, he can point to his private key, and that will get him in as git user on that server. Now, you don't really want to give all the developers access to your entire server, even as git user. There's just no reason that they should have unbound access to your server. So what you really want to do is give them access to something called git-shell. This is a restricted shell that ships with Git, like the whole Git package, and it is intended for use cases exactly like this. So if you grep git-shell in /etc/shells, if it is not there, you should probably add it so you can find out where it does exist on your system with which git-shell, and you could even just kind of redirect that, the output of that into /etc/shells, as long as you do a redirect, you don't want to just do it once. And then you want to do a user mod and make sure that your git user uses the git-shell, not, for instance, bash or tcsh or whatever your system may default to. And the command for that would be user mod space dash s for shell space git dash shell and then space and then the name of the user, which in this case is git user. So now git user can only use SSH to push and pull Git repositories, and git user cannot access a login shell. They can access a git shell, but they're not actually, you know, they can't SSH and then poke around on your server. They don't get an interactive shell. They get responses to and from Git, and that's it. And that's a good thing. You want that. Now, what we'll also do is create a group called git user, and you can do that with either group add, or you may find, depending on the system that you're running this on, that group that git user group has already existed. But that's what you want to create, as a git user group. And so you'll probably want to then add yourself, for instance, or whoever's going to be administering this git install, to the git user group. And you can do that with user mod as well. So user mod dash a, I think, for append, and then dash capital G for primary group, maybe, or no, additional group, and then git user and then space clatu or whatever. So now you've got a git repository, you've got a git infrastructure with an SSH backend. And so far, there's nothing that anyone can interact with because there are no repositories on the server. So for that, you kind of, you don't have to do it this way, but this is the the intended method of doing a Git of a sort of a centralized Git repository. And it's really not a Git. It is, but it's not a Git repository. It's a bare repository. And that means that it has no working tree. That is, no branch is ever in a checkout state. And that's important because remote users aren't going to be permitted or will not be permitted to push to an active branch. I mean, how would you like it if you were working in a dev branch and suddenly someone pushed changes into your workspace? That would not be very good. So you make a bare repository that can have no active branch ever, and you won't ever collide into little issues like that. I mean, I say little issues. They're actually huge issues. They can bring your work to a grinding halt. Now, you can put this bare repository wherever you want. You can put it in, well, you should put it in either slash opt or slash user slash local slash share, someplace like that. You don't want to put it in a user's home directory because the permissions there are pretty strict. So in some kind of in a location that's kind of meant to be a commonly shared location is probably a better idea, I have found. So you would want to do git init dash dash bare space slash opt slash foo dot git. And then you want to chown recursively, chown dash capital R, git user colon git user, so that's the user and the group, slash opt slash foo dot git. And then I take it a little bit further and do a chmod dash capital R 770 for slash opt slash foo dot git. And you can manage all that yourself and how, you know, whatever scheme makes sense to you. Like I say, you could put it in a home directory. I just don't like mucking around too much there because I figure there's a certain amount of privilege that I want people to have in order to get into a home directory. And there's a different set of permission that I want people to be able to get into a Git repository. So, and of course, I mean, the path is going to eventually be the thing that your developers look at. So probably the shorter, the better, I guess. It's up to you. But I mean, you don't even have to nest it in anything. You can just put it at the root level if you want, slash foo.git. There, it's there. So here's where it'll show up. So if I do on my client machine now, so now I'm the developer, I'm Bob, I guess. So git space clone space git user at example.com colon, and then the path to the repository. So if you've done slash foo.git, then that's colon slash foo.git. If you put it in opt, then it's colon slash opt slash foo.git. And so on. It could be whatever. Now you can also, I mean, like I say, if you do put it in git user's home directory, then it would just be colon tilde slash foo.git. And that's kind of easy to type. That's kind of nice. But it just depends on your tolerance level for mucking around with permissions and changing defaults and things like that. Now, if you did that right now, you would be warned that you've cloned an empty repository, and that's fine. It's just telling you that that a bare repository has been created and it's empty, and that's okay. That's a normal thing to happen before you've put anything into a repository. And this is it. You're done. This is your setup. You're now running Git on your server, and you can do whatever you want to do because you own that server. Your developers can push and pull as long as they have access to that server through the Git user. And they get access by sending you their public key. And then you put that public key in the Git user's authorized keys file, and suddenly they can log in to a Git shell and do all the Git things that they need to do. Keep in mind that this does not allow random people to pull from this Git repository, because you have not configured. The only gateway into this Git repository right now, as it stands, is through SSH. So if you want to allow HTTP pulling or Git protocol pulling, then you've got to allow that traffic on your server. Understood? Good. Okay, so the really cool thing about all this that I might as well get into are the hooks. The Git hooks that you can implement now because you've got full control over your environment. Now, Git has a couple of unique variables that it deals with, and it's kind of It's the documentation here is not super great. It's a little bit sparse, to be honest, but you could figure it out yourself by doing test Git hooks, or you can look at the examples that Git ships with in the .git/hooks directory whenever you create a Git repository. It's there in every single one. So there's, for instance, a pre-push.sample Git hook, which obviously is not live, but you can make it live by, I think, if memory serves, removing the sample, the extension, just pre-push. And the advantage of these sample files really is kind of the value of reverse engineering without really having to delve too deeply into documentation that, as far as I can tell, they don't really exist. The docs just don't exist for this yet. It's not something that's super well defined outside of the source code, I imagine. So the pre-push.sample one, for example, lists in a comment some of the things that you can expect from Git when pushing. So there's a variable automatically assigned. It's $1, positional variable, I guess, and that's the name of the remote that you're pushing to. So when Git receives a pushed item, it assigns to the $1 variable the name of the remote that you're pushing to. So if you're pushing to origin, then that's where that's $1. It's the name, the proper name of it. If you're not pushing to a name, you're just pushing straight, just directly to some URI, then that's the $2 variable. Or rather, that $2 is always the URI of where you're pushing to. But if there is no name to the place that you are pushing to, then $1 and $2 end up being the same. There's some more information about a commit. When you're committing, you get that after the $1 and $2. You get the local reference, the local SHA-sum, the remote reference, and the remote SHA-sum, something like that. Not all of the samples are quite that clear in the .git/hook folder, but they're an interesting read, and you kind of get an idea for what you can do based on that. And you can always also just write a really basic hook script and just echo $1, $2, $3, that sort of thing, so that you see exactly what Git is aware of when it's receiving pushes from you. It's important to note that Git hooks are not themselves version controlled. So Git is not, when you do a Git push of your data, your Git hook directory is not being pushed with everything else. Git hooks is just sort of the standard set of Git hooks of samples and the location of scripts that you write, but it is not being committed. So if you write a super fancy Git hook, you want to very much make sure that Git hook is version controlled by your or tracked or backed up or whatever by you manually. So you may just want to put it into a utils folder or something like that in that Git repository. I don't know how you want to do it, but you do have to do that yourself. Git does not back up the Git hook scripts that you write. As if that once they're in .git hooks, that doesn't get backed up. Okay, so let's review how a Git hook might work. So the one that I use, the only ones that I've used have been post-receive. That is, they get triggered after a commit has been received. There are other types of hooks, and like I say, you can look at the samples to see what's possible, but post-receive, I feel, is a pretty common one. So that and that's certainly the one that I've used, which is probably why I think it's so common. But yeah, I mean, I think it is common because a lot of times what you'll want to do is you'll want to get a push, and then you'll want to analyze it and see, okay, well, what exactly have I received? Oh, I've gotten something for the dev branch. Well, then I should email the person who needs to approve this commit, and then they'll get the email, they'll go check it, and then they'll review it and they'll merge it to master. Or, oh, this is a push to master. I should make sure that, I don't know actually what you would do on master. Well, like I say, if it's to master and it's you're doing web development, maybe you want to copy all that content to a web directory, and that way all of your changes go live and for the world to see, that sort of thing. So it's pretty common, I think, to look at the branch to which something has been pushed and then to trigger some action based on that. And there are a couple of different ways to find that information out. Like I've said, we've got a couple of different variables here that Git is aware of. And we know, for instance, that $1 is going to hold the name of the place that the person pushed to. We know that $2 is going to contain the URL. And everything after that, 3, 4, 5, 6, is going to be local reference, local SHA-SUM, remote reference, remote SHA-SUM. So what you really want there is the ref name, is what it's called. That's that's what would tell you the branch to which this is being pushed. So the way that you can find that, well, there are two different ways. The way that I know how to do it is the bad way, because the only Git hook programming that I've ever done has been in TCSH. And TCSH, if you're familiar with it, is a horrible shell. But that's what I know for this purpose. So the sort of, I'll call it the canonical incantation for finding the ref name in a Git push is /bin/tcsh, and then for each arg, so for each is all one word in tcsh, space arg, space parentheses, $ less than, close parentheses, and then you want to set argv to equal parentheses, $arg, close parentheses, and you want to set ref name equal $1, and that's the end of your loop, so end. That for loop basically reads in the first argument, which is $1, and then loops it over again and overwrites that with the value of the second one, which is $2, and then again with the third, which is $3, and so on. And this is simply the way to finally end up with the last argument, which will happen to be the ref name. And I happen to know that because I've done it a lot. Now, in Bash, you could do it actually a lot better. You could just use a Bash array, and then you could just tell it which item in your array to look at, but TCSH doesn't have arrays, so you just have to loop constantly until you run out of arguments, and it just so happens that I know that you will be left with the ref name. Now, once you have the ref name, you've got basically the contents. Well, you have access, I should say, to what the branch name is, and you have to do a little bit of parsing, but it's totally possible. So set space branch space equals space backtick git space rev dash parse space -- symbolic space -- abrev dash ref space $ ref name, close the backtick, and now you've got your branch name. So git rev parse -- symbolic -- abrev ref $ ref name provides you the human readable string label of the branch that has just been that is receiving a push. Now, with that information, of course, you can do whatever you want. From there, you can say, okay, well, let's set up an if loop, and if branch equals, or I guess it could be, what are they called, switches or cases or something? But anyway, again, TCSH is what I've been using, for Git hooks. So I would do like an if parentheses branch equals master close parentheses, then do, you know, whatever you want to do with the master branch. If it equals dev, then do something else, and so on. To actually use your Git hook, and when I say so on, I do mean it can do anything. I mean, this is running on your server, so if you want to play a song whenever something is pushed to master, then you can do that. You can trigger, you know, ffplay or mpeg123 or og123, whatever you want. You can just do whatever you need to do with your script. It is a system level script that has access to your entire server. So chmod plus x, so you put your little post receive script in .git/hooks in your repository. So the name of the script should be post-receive. That's what you would want to call it so that Git knows when to run it. Now, all the samples in .git hooks are suffixed with .sample, so they don't run. But if you call it post-receive and you chmod it with executable permissions, then it will run upon post-received when Git gets a push. So chmod plus x slash foo.git or wherever you put your repository slash .git slash hooks slash post dash receive, assuming this post receive is the one that we just wrote together. So now when any user commits to our master branch, then the Git hook is triggered, the post receive hook is triggered, and whatever you've assigned, you know, whatever you've provided for that condition then happens. So whether it's publishing stuff to a website or playing a song or emailing a developer to say, hey, you need to approve this and merge it at your leisure, whatever, that's how you do it. So Git hooks are really powerful, they're really cool, they can do all kinds of cool things, and it's more than just kind of, oh, this is kind of cool. It's really about integrating Git into your workflow. I've used Git to publish stuff to my web directory on a random server that I have out there for years now, and it's a beautiful process because I can just go into my Git directory, switch over to my development branch, do my little hacking on the little website stuff, the HTML and CSS, and then I look at it, make sure it looks sane, merge it into master, and then push. And when it gets pushed, if I'm not done, then I can push it to dev, right? I push it to dev and nothing happens. No Git hook is triggered. Well, the post receive is triggered, but it looks at the branch and it says, was it master? No. Okay, never mind. I'm not doing anything. So then if I finally am ready, then I can Git merge master, or Git merge dev, rather, from master, and then Git push origin head. And then the Git hook, again, because it got a push, it's triggered, and it looks at the branch, the ref name, gets the branch from the ref name, and it says, yep, this is a master, this was a push to master, so we need to copy all these files over to var www, and suddenly it's live. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing, it's really, really neat, and you should do it. And that's how to run a Git server. Raw, pure Git server. Nothing between you and Git. It's just you, Git, and a bunch of users. Not the most convenient thing. Next episode, I'm going to talk about Gitto Lite.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.